ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just one day after Jack McLennan's relationship fell apart, he vanished.
I couldn't believe this was happening.
Immediately, accusations started flying.
You need to cough up and you need to confess.
But it soon became clear there was so much more to the story.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Ngunnawal country in Parliament House, Canberra.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, wishing I was in Parliament House in Canberra, but I'm in Sydney. And PK, is it less ferocious down there in Parliament House than it was last week and in recent times? What's the vibe?
The vibe is kind of similar. In fact, this sort of sitting fortnight has a sort of humdrum, intense, but then humdrum. And that's because not much is happening other than a lot of rhetoric. And I'll explain. Labor's budget legislation is expected to pass the House today. I suppose that is a lot, but it is the House where they have a massive majority. So nothing unexpected there. That's despite some attempts by the opposition and even crossbench to sort of stall things. But of course, that's not going to happen because the government has a whopping majority. And there's been bipartisan diplomacy with the Solomon Islands Prime Minister visiting Canberra this week as well. Big political battle lines have been happening outside of Parliament this week, I think, too, Fran, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that humdrum thing, it's funny, isn't it? At the times when everyone's sort of interest has peaked in federal politics and the temperature seems sky high, then often it's a pretty flat week because these things take time to play out. But, you know, stuff happens off Broadway too. And in this case, that's the AUKUS debate, I think, PK. The Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister, Richard Marles, confirmed there was a bit of a shake-up to the elements of our American, US, Virginia-class nuclear-powered submarine fleets we're getting.
Yeah, we like old stuff.
Yeah,
did you know that?
Yeah, we prefer old ones. We like them to be run in. Is that remember when you used to get a car and you had to run it in for 50,000 Ks before it was optimal? Yeah. Well, that's what's going to be happen with the Virginia-class submarine. The thing is, though, that wasn't the original plan, and so the government's getting a bit hammered and really we'll talk to Charles Croucher about this because I know he's going to have views on it. It's really been a bit awkward for the government. So that's been one of the things. And the other big moment at the start of the week was a new poll, a Redbridge poll, which showed One Nation's vote eclipsing Labor's as the most popular political party. Pauline Hanson is going to address the National Press Club. That's never happened before. So this is putting Pauline Hanson on the same platform, the same status, the same level as the leaders of the other major political parties. And I think that's a significant moment for her and for the party and for the nation. But again, we're going to sort of pour through those numbers a bit with Charles. I know you've been talking to people a lot about that this week, so have I. And what are these numbers really telling us? I think it's worth sort of digesting them and just, you know, pulling them apart a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's right. Demographics are everything here and the demographic march is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Then, of course, there's Trump tariffs. They're back in the spotlight.
Everything
with the
US. Old is new again.
Totally. It's like Groundhog Day. The US set to increase tariffs on Australian imports to 12.5%. And who better to help us understand it than Charles Croucher, Nine News political editor. Charles, welcome to The Party Room.
It's so nice to be back.
This is great, Charles, having you back. You know, you used to be a US correspondent for Nine, you're a political sharpshooter, and this is the story of the morning, a new frontier in Donald Trump's tariff war. Washington says it will increase the baseline 10% tariff on Australia and dozens of other countries to 12.5%, accusing 54 nations of failing to crack down on goods made with forced labour, slave labour. So Our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, spoke to Mel Clark on AM today. We're recording this on Thursday. He completely rejected that. He suggested Australia has world-leading anti-slavery laws, which I believe is true. We do that. And he also spoke about what he called the ideological differences between the United States and Australia on tariffs.
There is an ideological disagreement where the United States administration has broken with what was decades-long understanding that tariffs are not positive for the country that is imposing them, that they increase the costs of goods and services in the country that is applying them to its consumers, and that free trade is in the interests of the global economy. It's in the interests of Australia. It's also in the interests of the United States.
So what does it all mean? Is this just another development in what's going to be an enduring battle with the US on tariffs? Donald Trump seems to have a complete infatuation with tariffs, Charles.
It's the one consistency of his policy for the, through these first 15 or 16 months of the second term, and even back to the first term. I mean, our trade officials, both here and in the US, have no idea what's going on with this. Mm. And that's the hardest part, right? This came from nowhere, surprised a lot of people. 12.5% is a weird figure, but it's also at a time when I think that 10% is due to come off soon, the blanket one. And then when you go into the weeds, some of the items that are exempt from this tariff are critical minerals, energy, beef, some fruits and vegetables. There's another big one I'm missing that we export a lot of. Pharmaceuticals is there as well. So it's hitting Australia, but then in all the really big items and really big goods that we export to them, they're exempt. So it's hard to know what the message coming from Washington is. I would say, and this is speaking from experience when, you know, I was back over there and this was the first term, but I don't know that the US trade officials would have too much of an idea of what's going on. They're scrambling as much as our officials are scrambling, trying to work out what's happening. And this is all before any of it is enacted and in place. So
I heard Joe Hockey this morning, and, you know, he used to be a former Australia ambassador to the United States, and he said it's about money. The US needs money and a lot of it. And that Donald Trump just thinks this is the quickest, easiest way to get it off other countries.
The other problem is, though, politically for Donald Trump, is that means that other countries then charge more for their goods, or the people that pay it charge more, and it hurts at the hip pocket of all the consumers. I mean, this is pretty basic economic stuff.
It's basic economic stuff, but it's been not economic stuff he's accepted the whole time he's been.
That's right. And look at the approval ratings over there at the moment. And there's a you know, a midterm election. Again, he's won two presidential elections, so there's a clearly a intelligent political mind that Donald Trump has and people in his team have. So they've obviously got a strategy here. But the old school thinking, and I'll admit my way of thinking, is that this is going to rust people further onto their anger, and that'll all get taken out in the midterm elections in November. Now, whether Donald Trump cares, because he's not on the ballot, maybe not.
I don't think he overly cares. Yeah. I mean, obviously, he doesn't want anything that reflects badly on him, but equally, you know, when he's not on the ballot, I mean, that's sort of the kind of way that he approaches everything, isn't
it? If you got the, I don't know, but if you lose the House and Senate, then life gets hard as a president, and maybe that gets him back in that combative mode that he likes.
Well, where does it leave Australia, though? Obviously, we are scrambling, like you said. That's absolutely accurate. But in terms of the politics here, we've got the Prime Minister. I thought he was pretty, you know, forceful this morning, speaking on AM about this. Didn't mince his words, very clear ideological difference on tariffs. Yep, we're going to keep having it out. And then the opposition, Angus Taylor's line, I thought was really interesting too. They, you know, they're rotten tariffs, suggesting the US shouldn't do this as a friend. A bit of bipartisanship perhaps in the language there.
And trying to separate himself from Donald Trump, which is, I think, something that perhaps Peter Dutton learnt too late that he should have done during the campaign, and the last time the tariffs really became a thing back on Liberation Day. This also is an opportunity for the government. I mean, there has been a bit of reporting around about the potential for the Prime Minister to duck over to Seattle when Australia's playing the US in the World Cup that's coming up, and try and, you know, brush shoulders with Donald Trump there to make sure everything's fine on the AUKUS front, but also potentially on the tariff front. You know, that's one of the things this government, through Don Farrell and Penny Wong's teams, have had a pretty good run in getting tariffs either minimised or removed, and getting our products back into places like China. So there is an opportunity there. Whether it moves the needle too much here, I don't think so. It's more noise from Donald Trump, but, you know, they'll take anything for a circuit breaker at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, and gosh, the Prime Minister hates going to sporting events, so that would be a hardship. But,
can tell you the travelling press don't mind it.
yeah, and remember, as you mentioned, Peter Dutton, remember during the last election campaign when the tariffs debate was on and he talked about, you know, Donald Trump thinking outside the box, you know, and then he had to sort of walk all that back. So I think that is a lesson. One Nation, of course, big supporters of Donald Trump. I'm not sure if they've responded yet, but there was some big news around One Nation at the start of this week, Charles. Some pretty explosive polling from Redbridge in the Financial Review had One Nation ahead of Labor as the most popular political party. This is the first time ever this has happened. Primary support jumped another 4 points to 31%. Labor's primary vote fell 3 points to 28%. So you can see the shift. And you know, Pauline Hanson did a round of news interviews, which she's entitled to do, of course, and she's getting more and more of that attention. And she reckons that she told ABC in Brisbane, I think it was, that she reckons, yes, she has what it takes to be Prime Minister. As she said, she's been in it for this long. If she wasn't ready to take the top job, well, what was she in it for? And she reckons she is.
So, Steve, at the moment, I'm head of the party. I'm leader of the party. Would I be able to do the job? I believe I could. All right, I do believe I have the ability, but it's another year and a half outside the election. At the end of the day, Steve, what I want is the best person in the job.
I was driving back. I was up in the Hunter Valley, back home for me doing an event on the weekend, and was driving back when I got a phone call about this poll. And sort of this emotion of like surprise. Obviously, this is a surprising poll. Anytime a lead like this changes, I don't think there's been a third party lead Australian politics since, you know, Menzies decided he'd make a Liberal Party. But also, it felt almost inevitable over the last few weeks. This kind of role that One Nation were on, maybe it was going to peter out. It sort of stopped around 25 and stalled there for a bit, but now it's kicked on again. And look, it sort of echoed some of the sentiments of people I was speaking to back home. That was sort of, there was a curiosity about this surge. There's obviously a momentum. Now, is it too early a momentum? Probably. You know, this kind of vibe can't last for 2 years. And there is that risk, just drifting back to the tariff thing. You know, One Nation has stuck steadfast to Donald Trump. And if the moves out of the White House get more nationalistic and more focused on the US at the expense of Australia, then that becomes a liability. And there was some polling at the end of last year that kind of suggested that as well. You know, you could roll out the pictures of Senator Hanson and Senator Roberts popping champagne corks in 2016 when Donald Trump was elected the first time around. So you could roll that back out again. But for now, I mean, that's counting for little, because clearly that swing is on. The thing we haven't spoke about, the Liberal Party down and the coalition down to 20%, you know, one in five. So 4 out of 5 voters choosing someone else, which is, you know, an extraordinary spot to be.
Again, not a surprise.
It is extraordinary, though, and I think worth critiquing what's happening for the coalition, because we've had a budget that, you know, most sort of polling shows hasn't been really very popular. Perfect opportunity for an opposition to gain traction. And yet Angus Taylor and the Liberals completely can't cut through. Like they're completely incapable of landing a blow. Even all of the opposition to the tax changes from Labor have been, those blows have been landed by like tech youth, you know what I mean? Like not anyone in this parliament.
Yeah, it's the hard part, right? And there was I think Fox and Hedgehog or one of those groups had a poll that had everyone around 26. So, you know, the different polls capturing different moments. But it is the combination of this sort of weird environment we have now, not just the fact that Pauline Hanson and One Nation are leading, but that there are two or three different policies doing the rounds at any one time from the two or three parties, if not four, when the Greens get involved. It's a level of debate and ideas that we haven't had here, I reckon, since the Rudd-Gillard wars. You know, Tony Abbott came in with a very, like, we are against them policy, not a we are for this, which was very effective for him. So, look, we are in a strange place, and it's that the Liberal Party brand that still, I don't know what the circuit breaker is, to use that phrase again, that needs to happen to turn things around. You know, some really bold plans in their budget reply, which is unusual for the first term budget reply, but that's sort of the world that the Liberal Party are living in now. And, you know, we have this idea that you would spend so much money on Andrew Bragg's idea of not just restoring the capital gains tax concessions but increasing them.
Yeah, that was wild. He said that to me yesterday. Like, actually, so that 50% discount, the Howard Costello era discount, it should be higher.
I would look to accelerate the CGT discount.
So you would create a, okay, there's the status quo, then there's the new change by Labor. You think it should...
I would go the other way.
Go further. So you can spend more, give up more money in the budget. And then also the indexing of income tax. It's a lot of money we're talking about turning over. And a lot of money to spend, you would hope, would cut through if you're one of the Liberal strategists. It's not yet. Maybe it's a slow burn. They're trying to lay the foundations and consolidate those rusteds on.
A lot of money to spend depends on where they're going to get that money from too. So there's always losers when there's money being spent. So that's to yet play out. But I think, you know, you said something interesting there. Well, you said a lot interesting there, Charles, to be honest.
I'll take one.
But one of the things you said was, you know, One Nation's relationship to Donald Trump. Well, that's true. Donald Trump is very unpopular. But that doesn't mean a lot of what he stood for and the MAGA supporters like is unpopular. And that's, I mean, I'm not saying One Nation supporters are the same as MAGA, but there are some elements of this simplicity, simple messages about, you know, making Australia what it was again when people felt good, that I think still stay true for people and are what a part of what is fueling One Nation. Enter Tony Abbott as federal Liberal president, and he's trying to take those messages and stick them, tattoo them back onto the Liberal brand. You know, he was very powerful, Tony Abbott, in 2010 and 2013 with his three-word slogans. Remember, stop the boats, axe the tax, pay down debt. Well, he gave this big speech, his inaugural speech as Federal Party president. He had a whole bunch of new slogans, and they're sort of touching those same messages, and there is a crossover. Put Australia first, stop the toxic taxes, end the mass migration, abolish net zero. You know, he's trying to get the messages that cut through, and these are messages that have a lot of crossover with One Nation. So, I mean, he's trying to do his best to revive this fight, I think, and give the Liberals a brand under broadly, you know, we are the Patriot Party. And that's a lot of the same clothes that One Nation are walking. Now, I know there's all, you can't out-nation One Nation.
Exactly.
But if you've got the pedestals, if you've got the platforms and the Liberal Party, the coalition, have the dispatch box, you know, you do have a platform to start being heard and cutting through, and I think that's what's been missing. But that's going to be a fight completely on the left. Labor's then going to have to work out what they're going to do about it, because the Redbridge polls suggest big trouble for them too.
Yeah, it does. And what you're talking about, Fran, is sort of a nostalgia for an imagined past in many ways, a past that didn't actually exist. But if you pick the eyes out of the good bits, then it did.
Yeah.
And maybe if your present isn't that crash hot, then it's easier to to have that imagined idea. For Labor, and there is probably a threat at some point of this populist sort of mentality or the anti-establishment mentality rearing up on the left at some point. The Greens had a little bit of it in 2022 and they did pretty well. I mean, they have the balance of power in every way in the Senate right now, so they could flex that muscle if they wanted to. It's sort of one of those things that hasn't happened here. I can't remember any stage that that's been a thing. So that's a threat there. For Labor, the message has to be that good governance is good politics, that that will eventually they'll come back, and you know, you burn your capital in this first budget, then you consolidate, and then you can use the, I don't know if we've decided on WATO or WATO or the Working Australian offset and crank that up come 2027, 2028 and really put some money back in people's pockets just in time for an election sort of mid-2028. But, you know, that idea that because the Liberal Party are weak, you'd go in 27, I think is probably off the table now.
So returning to the sort of surge in One Nation's support, we're seeing some other behaviours from One Nation that I think may be shifting the dial or also perhaps signalling their intent to be more mainstream, if you want to call it that. And I think that an example of that is Pauline Hanson saying yes to addressing the National Press Club.
Yeah.
Now, the National Press Club, to give people a sense of what it is and why it matters, it's obviously like, you know, the press gallery's place to ask questions of people who give big signature speeches, leaders and others, very traditional in many ways, very mainstream media, sort of not sort of people who have you know, algorithms. It's more sort of us who operate in the centre where I, you know, wish more people would operate. And Pauline Hanson saying yes, I think is kind of seismic. Am I overblowing it?
No, I think it's big too. I was really surprised when I heard. And, you know, great. I think it's good we're getting to see more of our politicians. That means mainstream or otherwise. Let's get more of it. There was a story one of my colleagues, Conor McGovern, did this week where he talked about and went into One Nation's headquarters and looked at this operation they've got going at the moment with vetting potential candidates. They've got some tech they've imported from the US that looks back and scrubs some of the online history, but also tries to weed out potential problems. I think they said they had 1,200 people express interest in running in Victoria, which is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Not just 1,200 people that are supporting them, but want to put their hand up and run.
Yeah, and now, I think privately they're saying this is a bit of an avalanche and they've got to be really careful here, right?
Exactly. That's the thing. You know, it's the old infantry winning battles but logistics winning wars. This is the logistics part of it. And I reckon there's every person that's either been involved in a campaign or run a campaign would hear that number and kind of recoil. because not only are you going to have, you know, bad apples amongst the bunch, but potentially angry bad apples when they get weeded out, and that could become a problem down the line too. But it has in the past for One Nation. But if this is to go to PK's point, if you're looking at a more mainstreamed One Nation, a more formalised, organised party, then that's another indication they're taking themselves seriously and seriously enough to run the country.
That's true. And it might go to some of the demographic shifts we're seeing in this polling. I mean, obviously, you can't overstate the importance of these polls too much because we are 2 years out from an election. But if you look at the Resolve polling, and they've analysed over a year, and they've found a big shift amongst women in the support for One Nation, and women from some of those what would have been perhaps blue ribbon Liberal seats for a change. I think this is surprising people, the typical One Nation voter, and it still remains the case, according to Resolve, is, you know, 55-year-old in the regions, but that's shifting. And the Redbridge poll also had, we already have talked on this show about Gen X men supporting One Nation, but that's shifting too. There was a jump in millennial support for One Nation. So these are interesting shifts. And if it led, for instance, to more female candidates for One Nation, that could be interesting too, because that's a weak point for the Liberal Party, has been traditionally.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's and it goes to, you know, women looking at Pauline Hanson and identifying her with in some way. But the other thing, of course, that comes with a rise in profile is scrutiny, and she'll get that at the National Press Club. And there's been some pretty, you know, rotten behaviour by One Nation lately in terms of their media events. You know, James Ashby, who's the chief of staff for Pauline Hanson, kicked the ABC reporters out of a One Nation event at the Farrah by-election, saying bye-bye to the ABC. In the Nepean by-election, they refused to speak to the ABC. And then last week, a One Nation staffer told Sarah Martin, who works for The Guardian, who is not a favourite of Pauline Hanson's, we know that, said shut up, just shut up, you know. And Pauline Hanson then got caught on a hot mic saying you should have said you're a nasty bee. So, you know, it's like that's not I don't know how that will play with the electorate, but I think that's really poor in a democracy.
It feels like a US or UK style of politics where voting isn't compulsory.
Yeah.
It feels like you start excluding people or turning people away. It's not how traditionally you win elections here. Maybe you're in a different era. I just, that sort of stuff. The other thing with the surge in female votes, and I'm very conscious, I'm not here to tell females how they think and where they vote.
No, particularly, don't worry, particularly we'll keep an eye on
women.
We like
to women hosts. But Barnaby Joyce popping up where he didn't need to pop up the other night at New South Wales State Parliament, an anti-abortion rally. I wonder how that lands.
Well, he came on my show yesterday and I quizzed him about it, of course, and he did. It's interesting, the way he frames it is, I think, smart politics, and he says, I wouldn't go if I was into being popular. And I think what he taps into there is, which is something that voters like, conviction and not just chasing what's popular, right? Yeah. Like, having some principles. Now, he's allowed to be pro-life and that's what he is. However, you are right. I think women who are on the right of politics also believe that they should be able to have abortions.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? It's one of those things that's very, very popular. And he conceded that actually in the interview. He's like, yeah, absolutely, that is. But doesn't mean I can't make this point.
Yeah, it's also not just women. It's a young men issue. Well, don't worry, young men think about it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But it also depends if it stops with Barnaby and his convictions or if it becomes One Nation policy and they try to get it up in the parliament, which, you know, there are moves on in several state parliaments at the moment. You know, not only is it not a vote winner, I just think it's really retrograde trying to put the criminal code back in, you know, to a health issue.
Mm. Yeah, but the other point is, sorry to interrupt, but I have to say, it's also not a first order issue, like cost of living. Like I heard Pauline Hanson talking about a woman who's living in a caravan park. And when she talks about that, it is compelling.
Mm-hmm.
She is really convincing. You hear her and you're like, yeah, that's wrong. In Australia, how can we have a woman living like that? You know, it's unfair. And then she blames lots of other things like immigrants, right? Yep. That immigration levels, which, you know, you can really argue the toss if that's why this woman is living in a car or why she's living in a caravan park. That's compelling. But Charles, banging on about sex selective abortion, which you can't even, it's not even really a thing in New South Wales, but they're conflating.
Yeah, and also like... You have to do a bit of fair bit of explaining to get to that. Yeah. I think it's easier, particularly with someone like Barnaby, to hear it, to pin it for voters and say, oh, okay, that's the same old thing. And you're right, if Pauline Hanson can position herself as the champion of battlers, then they will win a lot of seats in the parliament because there are a lot of people battling right now.
Yeah.
But if you get fringe issues or if you're having a birthday cake with Clive Palmer, who's hardly a champion of battlers himself, then it becomes a harder argument, but look, it's working, so
there's a big argument going on this week in the last few days about AUKUS. Now, in one way, it's a fringe issue because it's a huge price tag at a time when Australians know there's not enough money around to provide the services they need. But at the same time, it's about defence and national security. So, you know, people want the government to be on top of this. And it all kicked off when the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, confirmed we're going to get all second-hand or, quote, in-service Virginia-class submarines from the US instead of two in-service ones and one new one rolling off the docks. On 7:30, David Spears was interviewing Richard Marles and really it looked awkward. It looked like Labor's trying to make up reasons for why we think this is actually a great thing that we've got three second-hand submarines, not one new one, and couldn't talk about the cost savings, couldn't talk about how old the vessels will be, though if you work it out, it looks as though the ones we're going to get, which are called Block 2, they've been in service roughly 10 years, maybe a bit over, which, you know, that's fine. I thought, yeah, that's fine. We'll get them more quickly. They'll be all bedded down. They'll be all smooth. They'll have had their first big tune-up, and that's probably a good idea, which is what the government's saying. But then you look at the Collins-class submarines that we've got in the water. They've been running for 30 years. They're at end of life. We're going to try and keep them limping along. That costs a lot of money. And we're getting ones that are 10 years old. If they've only got a lifespan of 30 years too, is that a problem? What do you think? Is the government just sort of, does this reveal, Charles, that we're just a client state in this whole AUKUS agreement?
Client state. I love that. Wow.
We're a special client state if we are, because there aren't many of them for the US for this kind of technology.
No, that's true.
Your point was right, friend. Like the argument that you can, easier to service, easier to operate because you've got our people have been working on it now for, you know, 4 or 5 years. They know how this works. Mm. It's one fewer operation to work out of. That all makes sense. The only thing is, wasn't this part of the original deal then?
Well, okay, they have an answer on that. Let me just put it so that you can respond. Their answer is, well, there were negotiations, but the US didn't want that.
Oh, well, we were in the negotiations. So, I mean, we were happy with the outcome, to be clear. But, our preference would have been to have three in-service ones then. It makes it easier in the context of a very complex endeavour that we're trying to do here, which is for Australia to acquire this capability.
In other words, the US dictates what happens and we have to suck it up and pay billions.
Now they've changed their minds and it's become our favourite option now.
Yeah.
Does that... No.
No.
I mean, it doesn't work on me either.
It doesn't. The sniff test is, I haven't, you know, been in the boats or know what they're like. So maybe, you know, this is the the great deal, but then why was it so secretive? Then why can't you say what we're saving? Then why can't you say what boat we're getting? Like, there's all these things. The cover of secrecy that involves and revolves around these things is it just makes everyone skeptical.
Yeah. I think that's the issue.
You're trying to sell it, it's too hard.
I mean, I see a world where it does make sense that we just order three of these Collins class submarines and we've got them as quickly as we can in service. And if we're waiting for the US to build the new ones, now, yes, the Block 6, which is the new ones, have triple the firepower. But if we're not going to get one because they're just still only building them at 1.6 a year or whatever it is, and they're way behind, we need subs soon because our Collins class subs, you know, aren't cutting it anymore. Yeah. So I can see it makes sense. I think the bigger issue is what you're talking about, both of you, is the transparency around this and also the next phase, because if these ones do run out in 30 years, which is, you know, 20 years from when we get them, we've got to make sure those British ones are built, and that is a whole other question of capability, I reckon.
Oh, the British ones.
Scott Morrison's there.
I mean,
are we ever going to see the British ones, Charles?
It was never a great idea, right?
Well, we'll get I hope so. I don't know I'm at the stage now. We're so pot committed as a country. Like, what's the alternative? We just have a heap of drones and just drone swarm with those ghost sharks or something. Like,
I don't know. Everyone else is doing it.
We've kicked the can down the road so many times with these submarines between, you know, French and Japanese and all kinds of different styles. It's now at the stage we've got to throw everything behind it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we need to make it work is the argument.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
But the... Then no way. But the counter is we can't.
It costs too much. Yeah.
We don't control the speed.
Mm. That's the problem.
So we're stuffed.
Yeah. Well, you just hope the Brits pull their finger out.
And build and design a whole new submarine for us.
With us, yeah.
Mm. With us, for us,
all
around us.
$68 billion.
All right, look, just on, though, the way that this debate is playing out within the Labour Party and the Ed Husic intervention.
This deal has changed, and as a result, we need to recognise, is there anything that is going to improve this outcome or alter it? I don't think so. And there's obviously been, I mean, this is a great understatement, but you've seen within the broader movement a general disquiet about the nature of the deal itself. But putting all that aside, there's an issue about reality. And that confronting us about whether or not we will even get the new deal that has been put to us based on what's happening in the US.
Now it's been weaponized a little, obviously, by the coalition saying, really believed in AUKUS. They're wrapped that someone's broken ranks.
Until we know what Ed Husic's ongoing position is, whether he's going to continue to agitate this, and until, frankly, it's resolved whether Josh Wilson, an assistant minister, supports AUKUS or does not support AUKUS, then I think this is going to continue.
Ed Husic, former minister, not insignificant. Then we've got the Labor Party National Conference coming up in July. Lots of these issues will emerge. They'll try and control them so they don't come up at the conference, but, you know, some will.
Well, conference is in Adelaide too. It's sort of ground zero for the subs.
Ooh,
so
yeah.
That'll be a big thing for their...
Melanaskis.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like the more popular elements of the Labor Party, particularly among the states, still believe in this project. I think the majority of people believe in the project. The unions, and some of the unions are dead against it for reasons other than just that this doesn't look good, but... Ed's going to keep speaking out in the way he does and the way he has every right to. And in some cases, he is the moral conscious. He believes certainly of that caucus room, and I'm sure he's not the only one that feels that way.
Well, it's interesting, and I've critiqued it before because I think the critique is fair, really do.
Yeah.
I don't know. What's going on? Does anyone else have any views about anything? What are they doing?
If they wish to speak out, they
should. There's a lot of seat warming, isn't there?
Exactly. A lot of that, yeah. But they're ambitious and don't want this fight, as we've said about the Hanson crowd. You know, this is not the number one issue. It's the number one budget issue, but it's still not the fight they're having.
Mm. How about Peter Garrett heading up this inquiry? I mean, we all know what he thinks.
Yeah. He's come back. Like, it's sort of, it's unsurprising. I mean, he's a good voice. I think
trying to get a range of opinions in the public arena because, as you say, it's all been pretty nailed down until now. Mm. But look, speaking of the budget, we probably should because this has been an important week for the Prime Minister and the Treasurer. They've introduced their tax reforms, the cuts to capital gains tax and negative gearing into the lower house. The Greens and the Coalition are accusing the government of, you know, misusing parliamentary process, of being godlike or the Henry VIII discretionary powers to make changes after the legislation has passed. This is all because the government says we'll pass these laws, but we're still working with, you know, the startup sector and small business, and we're looking at discretionary trusts and all those things. What do you think, Charles? Can the government get away with that? Like, just say yes now and we're going to work on this. That's the way things are done in tax?
Well, it's going to be hard, right? I think they probably thought that with the Greens' support they could, or at least try it. The Greens now have, as I said, the ultimate balance of power. Yep. There's no other path given the coalition's stance. The only thing I would say, though, is that Jim Chalmers' first budget in this building as an MP was Joe Hockey's first budget as treasurer. Mm-hmm. He would have seen firsthand the damage that can happen if these issues stay stuck in the parliament and drag on and on and on. There would be a real urgency on the government side to get these things through.
They've laid the trap for the opposition.
Yeah, they've laid the trap for the opposition. If they want to go to the election and fight against them, fine. You know, that's fighting on Labor's turf. But there will be an urgency because of that reason, and because of the bleeding that's happened in the last couple of weeks. They'll know that the importance is there to get it done. Whether that factors in negotiations, it probably does, but they're in the hands of someone else, and that's just the parliament they've been dealt.
Which means they have to deal with the carve-outs more speedily, right? Like they can't – speedily I use actually very deliberately, because Claire O'Neill used the word speedily in this interview with David Spears on the weekend. They kind of need to clarify all of that, because there will be investment ramifications, won't there, Charles? I mean, like you just let it sort of hang. People make decisions based on these things.
Yeah, and sort of that's the what's happening with house prices at the moment, as well as the interest rates. We've seen that, but it's the reality. Until this goes to the parliament, I suspect most of it will get through, right? We're talking about some of the tinkering around startups and small businesses largely. The Greens would want grandfathering capped, I don't think it's going to happen. I think they're closer than to use my own analogy, than Joe Hockey was at any stage with that budget. It's just where it comes from how long the Greens want to drag this out, and what concessions the Greens think they can get on the way. It'll pass the House with flying colours. It'd be interesting to see where the Teals vote.
I do want a little observation from you on this, because I've been watching the Teals, and I've got to say that they deserve to be critiqued a little here. You know, we saw that gung-ho approach from Allegra Spender owning the tax space, and, you know, I was very hats off to her for taking such a leadership role. Gets hard, though, doesn't it?
It does get hard.
I mean, she knew capital gains tax was a thing that was beyond property, but now she's like, hold your horses. And it makes me laugh, because I'm like, oh, I suppose this is kind of what the ramifications of decisions.
Right.
There are always losers, mate.
Rob Oakeshott and Tony Windsor discovered, you know, 15 years ago.
Governing is hard.
I reckon they'll support it. I mean, the crux is there. I hope they go and vote. That's the only thing. Their vote won't be crucial in any way, shape or form, but I hope they vote one way or another.
Oh, surely they'll vote. And maybe it just depends on these carve-outs, and you're right about the speediness of it, because more and more voices are coming out with pretty sort of scary headlines like investment, you know, startup investment, venture capitals moving offshore, Australian companies moving to New Zealand, for heaven's sake, all these sorts of things.
For heaven's sake.
I mean, you know, the government just needs to shut all that down. And the only way to do that is to get this passed and then, you know, try and work. I mean, one criticism I did hear, and you would be much closer to this, Charles, because you were down there, the productivity summit. I heard from one player who was there, I can't remember who it was now, that said, well, we didn't talk about, you know, changing the capital gains tax on everything. We were talking about it in the context of housing, and this was not discussed. Now, the Treasurer and others are saying, well, this was what, you know, we talked all this through at the productivity summit. So I'm not sure.
They kept a lid on it so they didn't have this scare campaign and this fight for 6 months, and they're going to have it for 6 weeks instead.
Mm. Yeah, well, let's see how that goes.
Charles, what else are you looking forward to? Is there anything that you're like?
The midwinter break.
Same. We've got 2 weeks after this, don't we?
Look, yeah, we do. Look, everything is on standby until this war ends, and that's the biggest challenge, right? Is the fuel crisis getting any worse? It seems like people are powering on with it, but as long as that's around, that's going to be a problem that halts everything else.
Well, we've already seen some impact of it on the latest growth figures and productivity figures, and that's only with 1 month of the crisis factored in.
Those numbers won't reflect any of it.
You know, there's some pretty nasty figures coming down the channel.
That's the other thing, I guess, then. That's the, you know, does the fuel excise go back on?
Yep.
And then what happens?
Yep.
Charles, we love you.
I love being on here.
Yeah, you're just you're a delightful person, an excellent analyst, and it's been great to have you on the pod. Thank you.
Wonderful being on. Thanks so much.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks, Charles. See ya.
Bye.
Well, that's it for the Party Room today. We'll be back for a Question Time edition tomorrow. Keep sending your questions in for our next one because we love getting them. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And ABC editor of politics, friend of this podcast, David Lipson, will be back behind the microphone for Insiders on Background on Saturday. And then you'll be back with Politics Now on Monday, PK, because too much politics is never enough.
That's right. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. I'm obsessed with you sharing this pod, so please send it to your five best friends. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.